Good afternoon. I'm Cal Winslow, your host today. I'm very happy to be back with KZYX this summer with a new series of programs. I'm calling this one an antinomian hour. I'm using the word antinomian, an old concept, to describe people who work against the grain, people who think for themselves, people who believe that doing the right thing is the important thing. Our program consists of a series of in-depth interviews broadcast here on KZYX every Thursday this summer at 1 p.m. Our guest today is T.J. Clark. Clark is an art historian and a writer. He was trained at Cambridge University and at the Courtauld Institute of Art in London. In 1988, he joined the faculty at the University of California, Berkeley, where he held the George C. and Helen N. Pardee Chair as Professor of Modern Art until his retirement in 2010. In 2005, Clark received a Mellon Foundation Distinguished Achievement Award. He and his wife, Ann Wagner, who was a guest on this program last year, Ann Wagner, who also taught at art history at Berkeley, now live in London, where Clark continues to be active as a guest lecturer, author, and now as a poet. He's the author of many books: Image of the People, Gustave Courbet and the 1848 Revolution; The Absolute Bourgeois, Artists and Politics in France, 1848 to 1851; The Painting of Modern Life, Paris and the Art of Manet and His Followers; Farewell to an Idea, Episodes from a History of Modernism; and his most recent book, published by Princeton last year, is Picasso and Truth, From Cubism to Guernica. And that book was based on his Mellon Lectures in Fine Art, delivered at the National Gallery of Art in spring 2009. Clark also writes on political and social issues. He's the author, the co-author of the retort book, Afflicted Powers, Capital and Spectacle in a New Age of War. And he's a regular contributor to the London Review of Books. So with that, good afternoon, Tim.
Hello, Cal. Good to speak to you.
Oh, great. Glad you could be here. Well, let's jump right into your writing and your thinking about art, and start with, I think it was your first book on Courbet. You write that he painted at a time when political art and popular art seemed possible for the painter to combine. Could you tell us how you got interested in that kind of a subject and what you mean by political art and popular art?
Yeah, certainly. I got interested in it because I was interested in painting for reasons which I'm not entirely clear about, but painting took hold of me from early on. And also I was very interested in politics. Maybe an interest in politics is just as mysterious, but it was the two things that took hold of me in the 1950s, and the further on I went, the clearer it was that I wanted somehow or other to think about the connection between the two, the connection between the picture and the world. So I started off by being really, really fascinated by those moments. And, you know, there aren't all that many of them, in my view, when a painter or a sculptor or an artist really exposed him or herself to a social and political situation and tried to make painting or sculpture or sometimes other kinds of imagery that really participated in political struggle. And that often involved, I mean, so the word we haven't got to yet is popular, that often involved trying to move art away from the realm of the high, the elite, the realm of tradition, though often these artists were deeply, deeply obsessed with tradition and, you know, tremendous admirers of the artists who came before them. But often when an artist wishes to make art politically effective or active, it involves trying to sort of make connection with a wider audience, a different audience, an audience, you know, that isn't confined to the patron class, the connoisseur class, moving it out and trying to put it in connection with the common people, the populace. And that's certainly what Courbet tried to do, very self-consciously tried to do in the revolutionary circumstances of 1848 in France.
And so how did he try to do that? I think I noticed the phrase or references to art and the people and the image of the people. Was that the way he went about it?
Yes. Well, that's the title of one of the pair of books that I wrote right at the beginning about art in and around 1848. Image of the People. I mean, it's a double-edged title, you know. It means an image which portrays the people, which he certainly tried to do. He opened his art to a different kind of subject matter. The key paintings he does in the years after 1848 are paintings of small-town society, the local urban bourgeoisie in a very remote part of France, in the mountains of the Jura, and also, of course, crucially, descriptions of the peasantry and, indeed, in probably his most famous painting, The Stonebreakers, not just the peasantry, but really the proletariat, the landless laborers who are put out to work breaking stones to make the local roads. So part of the story is reaching out to a different kind of subject matter, making the people his subject. But of course, the title Image of the People is as I say, double-edged. It surely also implies an image for the people, belonging to the people. And that task, right? Not just a question of subject matter, but a question of a form, of mode, of the kind of painting you do, the kind of visual language you use. That's a much more difficult matter. He tried to make a grand, large-scale oil painting that steered image making much closer to the kind of crude, naive, direct imagery that he and his friends so much admired when they saw it in the kitchen and sitting rooms of the peasantry. So one of the things that's immediately said about his painting, because it's means of putting the picture together is so deliberately simple, additive, often seeming not much concerned with complicated spatial depth and subtle modeling, so that often the word the critics brandish, you know, in order to kind of put it down is flat as a pancake, flat as a playing card. Those are phrases that really are used at the time. So, but it's all deliberate. He's trying to make an art which is of the people in two senses, showing them and also steering the language of painting towards a kind of image making that they might partly recognize. I mean, it's not it's not just in some kind of condescending way aping the popular, but it's trying to make a synthesis of the directness and no nonsense and material qualities of popular imagery, and of course the the extraordinary complex achievements of the European tradition in art since the Renaissance.
About the tradition, just wondering, did his work involve to any degree a break with a tradition? And I wonder, in another context, I was thinking of the fact that the tradition often involved a kind of a good way and a wrong way of describing ordinary people.
Yes, well, I mean, all revolutions in art, it seems to me, or anyway, all revolutions in art that are worth taking seriously, can be described two ways. They can be described as breaking with tradition, and they can be described as sort of renewing and enlarging and pushing a tradition forwards towards new kinds of achievement, building on tradition. I certainly think that Courbet did both. You know, he broke with tradition in the sense that making a massive painting, which you put up in the annual exhibition in Paris, which shows, rather clumsily dressed middle-class mourners gathered around the grave in a faraway place, and sort of rather naively and simple-mindedly going through the rituals of burial and sort of showing off their Sunday best. Making a painting which is, more than 20 feet long, it's a vast, ambitious painting, which Courbet himself described as a history painting, which is a challenge in itself to the previous notion of history painting, because of course history painting up to then had been about sacred and antique subjects, heroes, saints, and so on. Making a history painting of that kind, of course, is a break with tradition, but then you look again at the picture and you realize how deeply it is engaged with, for instance, with the Dutch tradition and a whole line of painting within 17th century Dutch painting, which celebrated exactly this kind of bourgeois, middle-class, commonplace occasion. I mean, the most grand and extraordinary of them all, of course, which we all sort of know of, is Rembrandt and Rembrandt's Night Watch, right? Which is just a kind of, a citizen's military, the citizen's militia parading in the streets. We know that Courbet knew and admired that picture. And in some sense, he's trying to make a new Night Watch. But he knows that in order to make a new Night Watch, he has to abandon a lot of the pictorial subtleties and fireworks that Rembrandt was a master of, and move the picture towards something altogether deliberately plain and straightforward.
So I think you've kind of answered another question I had, but maybe since it's probably something that's still with us, I'll ask you for just another word on it. And that is your fairly strong statement that Courbet wanted to put an end to the connoisseur. Could you just tell us what you think that means?
Is that something I say in the book?
Yeah.
It's a little bit crude.
Well.
but... Yes, I mean, look, he wanted to put an end to the situation in which intense and informed response to the arts was the privilege of a few. You know, the word connoisseur is sort of endlessly used and abused, but I mean, you know, roughly what we mean by it is someone born and raised into the privilege of art, right? With an ingrained confidence about his or her understanding of, and that's usually bound up with ownership of, the world of art. Courbet wanted to break with that. You know, he did say this famous exchange. One conservative critic accused him of wishing to encanailler l'art, which is hard to translate, but it sort of means, you know, dragging art into the gutter or dragging down art among the canaille, the poor and dispossessed. And Courbet replies, and he says, yes, exactly, that's what I want to do. Il faut encanailler l'art. We must drag art into the gutter.
And you also write that in Courbet's time, it was still possible to do the sorts of things he tried to do with political art and popular art. And so just perhaps, what were the times and what happened?
Well, 1848 is a moment of multiple revolutions all across Europe. A moment in which bourgeois society is really, really shaken. And a moment, it's not for nothing that it's, fundamental to Karl Marx's vision of history, and he writes some of his most powerful pamphlets and historical studies about the 1848 revolution and its aftermath. It is a moment of class struggle. There's this extraordinary moment in June 1848 where the Parisian working class really rises up against the previous bourgeois revolutionary regime, and says it has not gone far enough. It is not offering us employment. It's not mobilizing the state to deal directly with the question of poverty, and there are weeks of bloody and appalling barricade conflict, which everyone recognized at the time was the war of class against class. So it's that situation and its aftermath that Courbet is operating in, a kind of moment in which, it's a terrible moment. And in the end, the June days are fought to an absolute appalling finish, and the working class is utterly defeated. But it's also an open moment, right? It's a moment in which there's real uncertainty about where modern civilization goes, modern societies go next. For 3 or 4 years, from 48 to 52, there's tremendous fear, really, among the middle class about what might happen as a result of universal suffrage. What are the peasantry going to do? Who are they going to support? How are they going to be controlled? And it's in that situation that Courbet's art is done, and it's also, it's the situation in which his art is seen as dangerous.
Tim, I need to pause for a moment here. This is KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host this afternoon, Cal Winslow. Our program today is An Antinomian Hour. Our guest is T.J. Clark, Professor Emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, who now lives in London, where we're talking to him. I don't know if this is chronological or not, but you move on to writing about later periods, I think, and certain terms come up that I find very provocative. But taking, again, one from a title, A Farewell to an Idea, what could you maybe connect this to what you've been talking about?
Well, yes, Farewell to an Idea, which, you know, comes... I mean, of course, we have been talking about a couple of books that I wrote half a lifetime ago. You know, I'm kind of still, you know, I'm on their side still, and I'll speak for them. Farewell to an Idea is much more recent. You know, it's a turn-of-the-century book. And it's about... It's a series of studies about... the character of modern art, the character of the art we call modernist, and it stretches, you know, from the French Revolution on to New York in the 1950s, abstract expressionism, and so forth. Farewell to an Idea is, I guess, there's a sort of melancholy ring to it, because I do think, you know, certainly... when I was writing it in the 1990s, everyone thought that, in some sense, modernism had come to an end. That may or may not have been true. But certainly the idea, you know, of of an art that confidently rode the horse of modernity, thrived on modernity, took modernity as its subject and its instigation. I mean, there was decreasing confidence, I think, in that, and that went along. I mean, that's, I suppose, is the other side of Farewell to an Idea. There was also a sense, after all, following the fall of the wall. And the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1989, that we were at the end of a long century of revolution. We were in a period of sort of deep crisis as far as the idea of a left politics or a socialist politics or a revolutionary politics was concerned. It was a decade in which capitalism seemed invulnerable. Hard really to understand that now. So partly the book is about what was the character of an art that was confident in the modern, fascinated by modern life. That wanted to take advantage of modernity and push modernity ahead. And to what extent was that confidence in the modern bound up with a belief that modernity might in the end revolutionize itself or be revolutionized, that modernity contained within itself energies and forces and contradictions, to use the old Marxist word, that might in the end break it apart and reconstellate it and usher in a new kind of social and political order. It's the coexistence, if you like, of a certain set of social and political hopes and beliefs with a certain set of artistic experiments.
Could you just step back and maybe tell us, just give us a little more about what exactly you mean by modernity? Is that all right? What are its aspects that are of interest to you?
Yeah. Well, it's a huge topic, and of course, I mean, you know, it's partly what the book is about. What on earth do we mean by modernity? We mean, I think, the kind of social order and mental world brought on by the arrival of a mercantile, industrial, capitalist society. I mean, it's been long in the making. particularly in Europe, and then in America. We've been creatures of capitalism in one form or another since Burgundy and the North Italian cities at the end of the Middle Ages. So it had been long in the making, but in some sense, it comes. What society is more capitalist and, in a sense, bourgeois than the Netherlands in the 17th century, proudly imperialist and a trading and dealing nation absolutely sure of itself as such. So long in the making, but in a sense crystallizing as a world order in the U.S. and Europe in the 19th century, and of course in their vast imperial possessions. So by modernity, I think we mean the social order, the mental world, the attitudes to life, the kinds of daily conduct and understanding that go with this new world. Many catchphrases spring to mind. Individualism, an acceptance of risk and change and contingency, a positive relish for a society where to use the overused Marxist phrase, all that was solid melts into thin air, where previous hierarchies are put in question, where religion loses its hold, at least on the detail of daily and weekly conduct, or increasingly loses its hold, right? Of course, we are living in the 21st century in a world still dominated and haunted by all kinds of religious revivals and fundamentalisms and determinations to resist modernity's secularizing, dissolving force. I mean, that seems to me fundamentally what Islamism, extreme Islamism, is all about. But nonetheless, right, in the 19th century, secularization, right, the erosion of traditional and religious boundaries, limits, structures is central. So, that's the beginning of a description of what we mean by the modern.
And just briefly, could you help us to see this in a painter we may know of, or the someone you've written about?
Well, I mean, the second book was called The Painting of Modern Life, and it was about Paris in the art of Manet and his followers. So take Manet, Manet and the Impressionists. They thrive on, not just on the subject matter of the new Paris, it's shops, its streets, its malls, its arcades, its improvised bathing and sailing resorts, its suburbs, and so on. They thrive on all that apparatus of modernity. And it's new, right? People are struck and to some extent sort of baffled and surprised by the way in which the cities are improvising a new kind of identity for themselves. They thrive on what's happening. They paint it. But more profoundly, I think, and this is what the book's about, they try to somehow or other ingest into the very way they paint a feeling for the openness, the contingency, the quickness, the ephemeral nature the kind of uncertainty of existence in these new spaces and social structures. So man is the master of all this, right? Mm-hmm. You know, he shows us, he doesn't show us just what's happening. He certainly does that, right? You know, look at these bourgeois taking their luncheon on the grass. Look at what happens in a big, gaudy café concert. Look at the how people behave when they're sailing by the river or promenading. Look at the shops, and so on. Right? He shows us all that, and of course he's often criticized. How dare you? Why do you take these subjects to be worth painting? But not only does he take them to be worth painting, he thinks deeply about, well, how shall we paint this new way of life? What kind of quickness and attack and simplification and abbreviation and impact and turning of everything to face you as if it's challenging you, what way of painting is appropriate to sort of get this new attitude to life on canvas?
Tim, I wonder if we could change the subject just a bit and
sure.
go back to another part of your life. We've been talking about hierarchy and so on. I still think of the University of California as a public institution for ordinary people. You taught art history for many years at UC Berkeley. Art history, probably, I'm not wrong to say, still has a kind of a reputation as being far from the practicalities of growing up and becoming educated. How did you approach the subject of, or is that wrong, or how did you approach the subject of art history for kids?
I have to say, look, I mean, from very, very early on in a contact with a certain marvelous group of French leftists, one lesson one, don't base your politics and your way of life on guilt. I have absolutely no interest, you know, in, I mean, it, look, it's not wrong that art history is still to some extent an elite preserve. But you know, if you go on agonizing about that and somehow or other building into your teaching a sort of self-conscious atonement, I just think that's deadly. And actually, I think, you know, that it kind of infests so-called progressive art history in a way which I, you know, am utterly unsympathetic to. You know, the profession is full of people who seem to think that the way to solve this dilemma is to trot out in front of students a kind of reach-me-down condescension towards art itself, and, you know, divest their students of the illusion of art. That's used to be an old catchphrase.
Mm.
Well, to hell with that. Okay. Most students don't have the illusion of art, especially one heck of a lot of students that I encountered in the University of California. You know, they've not been brought up to worship and revere art. They've not been reared on all the kind of museum art world mumbo jumbo. They wanted to know about art, and one of the things they I think should be taught is that, look, art is often a preserve of kind of lazy thinking and elite attitudes, but it's very, very often goes far beyond them. Art seems to be if we, as I do, take the Paleolithic cave paintings as the beginning of some strange activity called art, art seems to be a absolutely basic and in some sense necessary human activity. And like all human activities, it covers an enormous range, right, between the trivial and the time-serving and the merely playful. There's nothing wrong with the playful. But between that and the intense and the deep and the challenging. I certainly wanted my students in Berkeley not to be, you know, inculcated into some kind of cult of art, but I wanted them to understand that, you know, face-to-face with the achievements of a Piero or a Goya or a Poussin, you're really faced with something extraordinary and difficult and demanding. It always used to absolutely infuriate me that sometimes the same professional intellectuals who would absolutely be shocked to the core if anybody questioned, you know, the intellectual power and untouchability of their Foucault and Derrida and so on, were all too ready to say, if you take X or Y artist too seriously, you're just falling in with ideology.
Okay. And so on the more positive, what did you teach the students? What did you want them to come away with?
Well, I mean, I think actually, Cal, I've already sounded the positive, right? Which is the, you know, to talk about the whole range of what art does and where it belongs and who it belongs to and what it's capable of, and try to talk about you know, what the highest artistic achievements do, what they tell us, why they might be, you know, really important to our understanding of life. The way in which Manet and others may be indispensable to anyone who wants to come to terms with the modern. Not just in order to, you know, kind of delight in it, although there's nothing wrong with delight, but also to think about, well, if this is what it is, and we have our doubts about it, we see the way in which these qualities of the modern are bound up with other characteristics of our society that we distrust and want changed, well, maybe art can tell us what it is we have to change, what it is we have to challenge, what the appeal of modernity is, and therefore, you know, the possible ways in which it could be challenged and dismantled.
Tim, I need to interrupt again, or
sure.
Pause. I'm not supposed to say interrupt, and identify our station. It's KZYX, Mendocino County Community Radio. I'm your host, Cal Winslow. Our guest today is T.J. Clark, who's professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley. I wanted to ask you about several more things, Tim, and we still have some time, but let me turn to your last or your latest book, and that's a book called Picasso and Truth, just published last year. And among other things you say in the book, you say that you owe your reader an explanation for adding a book on Picasso. Could you just say a word about why Picasso, and then perhaps we'll move on to the very interesting final discussion of that book about the well-known painting Guernica.
Sure. I mean, I owe the reader an explanation because there are too many books on Picasso and too much hero worship and too much sort of tittle-tattle and poppycock about, you know, his mistresses, his misogyny, etc., etc., etc. I think we need a book and books on Picasso because most of the books are so bad, and Picasso is still with us. He's still so important, whether we like him or not. And surely anybody who takes him seriously is going to have mixed feelings about this extraordinary body of work. Whether we like it or not, it seems to speak something about the 20th century, which is difficult, fundamental, rebarbative, brilliant, often beautiful, often monstrous. And it's trying to make sense of those extraordinary contradictions. That's what the book's about.
And the truth? Why the truth?
Well, I mean, in a sense, Picasso and truth is a sort of challenge to, you know, the kind of built-in academic skepticism about truth, about the idea that there is such a thing as truth, and even if there is, that representations or can ever approach them or adequately match up to them. I'm really unsympathetic to that postmodern, post-structuralist stuff, and the title is all about. I mean, the book is all about the fact that Picasso was utterly unsympathetic too. That he believed profoundly in the idea that painting wouldn't matter if it didn't constantly strive to tell the truth about a particular situation. That involves invention, right? I mean, painting is not mapping, is not, well, even mapping, of course, it involves invention. Of course it does. Painting is an imaginative activity, but it won't matter to us unless we sense in it that it's got hold of and trying its best to convey to us some truth about the world we live in. Often that truth will be very unwelcome to us. And there, you know, I mean, there remains tremendous hostility to Picasso. And I think that it's based in an uneasy or unconscious recognition that the truth he may be telling us about ourselves and our society, about modernity, is one we wish wasn't true and don't believe is true, and yet we sense the power with which he presents his case.
And an entire chapter, the last chapter, which again was based on a lecture you gave at the National Gallery, is devoted almost entirely to a single painting, Guernica. Why the importance of that for you?
Well, it's the Picasso icon, you know. I mean, it is his most famous painting. I sort of approached it almost reluctantly, but I knew I had to, you know. It's a very extraordinary painting, you know, one of the largest paintings he ever did. It was done, you know, the comparison with Courbet is pretty direct. 1937, at the time of civil war and a general struggle in Europe between fascism and communism, which was being played out in Spain in the so-called Spanish Civil War. And Picasso is a Spaniard living in France, is deeply engaged with and oppressed by what's going on. You know, he's not a political artist, but he's called on to make this statement on behalf of the Spanish Republic, right, fighting for its life against Franco's fascism. The painting is made for and first shown in the Spanish Pavilion in the 1937 exhibition, in Universal Exhibition in Paris. And ever since, it's become our image of what modern warfare is like, about what it's our image of the truth of mechanized warfare from the air. And as such, of course, it remains. You know, here we are, right, on the Israelis are bombing the Gaza Strip, right? This very moment as we talk, it never dies. It never goes away. It is the image that lives on in our psyches of the truth of bombing, which bombers don't want you to think about or to see.
In your 2005 book, which you co-authored, "Afflicted Powers," you refer to an episode the day that this painting, Picasso's Guernica, which I think still hangs in the United Nations building, was actually covered up. Could you say a word about why you chose that episode to begin that argument?
Well, it's a good yarn, Carl. You know, I mean, you perhaps. Perhaps one shouldn't be too hooked on it. I mean, it's a scandalous story. As the U.S. and the U.K. were preparing their invasion of Iraq, and of course, sort of, you know, bribing and cajoling the U.N. into a sort of acquiescence, they decided, or the U.S. decided, but still, I mean, of course, Blair agreed, that the tapestry version of Guernica that hung in the anteroom just outside the U.N. Security Council chamber should be covered over with Velcro, because they didn't want, because it was the usual place where odious state spokespersons, right, made their mealy-mouthed pronouncements, and they didn't want those pronouncements, particularly the American and British ones, to be happening with Guernica right behind them. So, you know, and it was covered over, and we know, you know, what happened next and what is still happening. Hundreds of thousands of lives and futilities later. So it's a terrible and pathetic story. Don't make too much of it, because, of course, in a sense, any image of warfare that in that particular space would have been anathema to the powers that be, right? You know, a large-scale photograph or whatever. It still leaves us with the more challenging and interesting question of why is it that Guernica lives on in so many contexts, that it's mobilized and reused and rethought by in so many parts of the world, in so many kinds of struggle situations. And that, if you like, is what lies behind the chapter in the book. I want to somehow or other get at what it was about the horror and obscenity of bombing that Picasso truly gave form to. All right, I mean, that's always my question. It's not a question ultimately of subject matter, but of form, I think. That art is about articulating a certain subject in a way which gives it continuing life, in a sense, definitive form that we can all look at time and again and feed on, and which sort of feeds into our understanding of what the reality we're confronting really is.
And Afflicted Powers is about that, and it's about war, and it addresses some problems or concerns, I think, that you have about the left or the opposition. And I wondered if you could just say, in the time we have left, a few things about that. You've also written a very provocative article, one that was published in the New Left Review called, I think it's called, A Left with No Future. What are your thoughts on those subjects, Tim?
Well, you know, I mean, look, most of my life I've been in a kind of a sort of lover's quarrel with the left, you know. I mean, that's really reaches far, far back. Hard to sum up what the issues are here. I'm kind of deeply out of love with the left's moralism, with its kind of belief in a logic of history, with its inability to own up to the kind of horrors of the so-called socialist past. I think, I mean, this, unfortunately, I have to say that it seemed to me particularly striking in the case of the American left, although I understand that, you know, it's deeply embattled and marginalized situation brought on this pathology, but I really do think it's a pathology of the left not to truly come to terms with what happened in the Soviet Union and in China, what belief in a one way forward in history as being representable by a single party and a single party in possession of the truth, what all of that led to in terms of utter squalor, misery, and violence. I think that's something that we on the left truly have to get in our bones, right, and sort of rid ourselves of completely, purge ourselves of completely. So that's part of it. When I called this essay For a Left with No Future, when I gave it that title, you know, I meant that we've got to purge ourselves of the idea that history has a logic, and we have a logic, and we are the avant-garde that will bring the future into being. That's what the Bolsheviks believed, and their belief was dreadful for them and for tens and hundreds of millions likewise. So that's part of the quarrel. It's bound up with many things. It's bound up, you know, I very much revere, maybe this brings us back to your title for these hours, right? The antinomian tradition. I think the left has to come to terms with a parallel set of voices in its past and present, which are resolutely disabused of all these illusions, and radically really have divested themselves of the idea that they have the monopoly of truth. Those are some of the things. Cal, it's very difficult to talk about this, right? Because this, in a sense, is sort of talking about the kind of to and fro of the politics of one's whole life.
But it has to be talked about, Tim, and I appreciate that you're willing to do this. I just wonder, we're kind of getting toward the end of our time, and I wanted the listeners to know one last thing about your work. And so let me just say that last year, Tim, you and your wife, Anne Wagner, were the curators of a marvelous exhibit at the Tate Gallery in London, and it was called Lowry and the Painting of Modern Life. So back to painting. Lowry is L.S. Lowry, who's much loved, I think, in Britain, but perhaps not well known here. I wondered if you could just tell us a bit about why you did that and what it was like. And I wanted to tell the listeners, too, that I see the book is actually available here. It's published by the Tate, and it's called Lowry and the Painting of Modern Life. How did you come to put on a major exhibit at the Tate?
Yeah, it was a strange story. I mean, I think it's part of, you know, my so-called homecoming, although I have very, very mixed feelings about the idea of England as home. I mean, I am English, and you hear that, but I don't know. I didn't live most of my adult life in the U.S. for nothing. I love the U.S. with all its crazy problems and monstrosities. The Lowry show was part of homecoming. Lowry is a very extraordinary artist. He's not a great artist, Picasso, but he's as close as England gets, and in some sense, as close as anywhere gets to a painter in the 20th century who made his life's work the realistic depiction of working class life, the working class industrial back to back street city, and he did it in full knowledge of what he was up to. He was not a naive. He saw himself in some sense as the inheritor of the many impressionist modern life, modern Paris tradition. I think I can do what they did. I think I can show the industrial scene, that was his word for it, the industrial scene. Nobody seems to have done it seriously, so let me give it a go. And he did for four decades and more. It's strange art. It's a limited art. It has a certain naivety about it, but that brings us back to Courbet. Its naivety is quite deliberate. Its plainness is quite deliberate. And Lowry revered Courbet, of course. He knew exactly what he was up to. So Anne and I plunged into this. We both knew that we needed each other's eye and mind if we were to make anything of it, and the collaboration was exciting. It was also hell, we're deep in the kind of major British institution, and they completely panicked in the face of many of the things we wanted to say. Even the words working class were provocative, it seemed, and we were asked whether we could say working populations, plural, instead. Well, we said no. So it was a wild ride, and of course, it divided the critics completely. Many, many parts of the British art world would rather be seen dead than taking Lowry seriously. He's a popular artist, and the London art world, turns up his nose at him. But so you get the flavor. It was a trip.
Sure. Tim, we've run out of time. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Very interesting and informative, and I think we really all appreciate it. And I should also thank the listeners for tuning in today and say that this is Cal Winslow. I'll be back next week at this same time with the Antinomian Hour. So good afternoon for now.